And thank you for joining us tonight, singing along with me on these little tunes, too. You're listening to Coast AM. Connie Willis here. Hey, when you get a chance, if you haven't ever done it ever, well, first of all, smack, 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 because you got to, go to coasttocoastam.com. Go to our website. It's great. When you're going around looking for different things to, maybe you want to study something a little more, find something a little different or unique, and you go to all these other YouTube channels and this and that, don't forget to go to ours. Go to our website. One of the stories, this is interesting, an iguana jumps on a fireman's helmet to escape the burning house. And he did. Smart iguana. Got a picture of it too. Really? That was huge. That had to tilt the head of that fireman, no doubt, when it jumped on it. But check out the picture. Also, you'll see that the Hubble captures some colliding galaxies. To me, it kind of looks like the profile of some sort of humanoid or something like that. Check that one out. Tell me if you don't see the same thing. Also, a mysterious trail of four-toed footprints discovered atop a frosty car in England. Yep, those are interesting little prints too. Huh, I don't think I could figure out what that one is. Wow, go check that out. See if y'all, that is kind of interesting. It's in England. We need somebody English to let us know on that one. Also in Coast, you missed it. That's a fun articles that we have in there. And a misidentified potato sparks search for human remains in England. Ooh, because it's not a potato. If you look at it, it's a toe. Oh, man. Okay. You know, some can be spooky, some can be creepy, and some can make you just do what I just did. That's our website. We have great designers and we have great contributors. They do a wonderful job. Check it out. It's our website at coasttocoastam.com. With stations all over the U.S., North America, Puerto Rico, Guam, and by satellite, we are Coast to Coast AM. I'm Connie Willis. Catch me at my site, which is BlueRockTalk.tv. Blue Rock, the Earth, just talking. Doing a little earth talk, right? BlueRockTalk.tv. I talk to Bigfoot researchers, dogman researchers, alien researchers, investigators, remote viewing. It goes on and on and on. And I love it. It's a lot of fun. It's live. It's interactive. You are part of a community. It is not a podcast. It is not 101. So if you can bear it, if you can handle it, and then we take you to creepy hotspots, live investigations for 3 to 5 days. Oh, man. Or overnight stays at like Waverly Hills or something like that. Can you handle it? Do all that virtually? Yeah, because we're the ones that are having creepy things around us. You get to watch from the comfort of your own home. Good for you. Well, I hope that you will check it out and join. It's a whole community, and you can, for listening to us and hearing me tonight as a Coast fan, you can get half price for the next 48 hours. I've got it set up for you. Shh, don't tell everybody else, because there's only going to be a limited amount of people. When I get to a certain point, I'm stopping it. I want the intimate boutique membership, I don't need hundreds of thousands. Done that. Just want this a nice, intimate type thing where it just all does its own thing, plays out really nicely. So it's BlueRockTalk.tv, half price for the next 48 hours. Forever, by the way, forever, you'll get that. So speaking of creepy places, I'm going to have to get a location from our next guest, AP. He's always been fascinated by supernatural beliefs and stories, and it's really nice talking to him. When I met him over the phone, he finds all this delving into the folklore of the past provides a window into how people interpret the world around them. And so he got into looking for some really unique things when he came across some cool stuff, and I'm going to let him fill in the blanks of the things and the stuff. His main focus for a number of years has been vampire accounts. So he explores how our modern notions about vampires compare to actual folkloric beliefs in his book, Vampires of Lore, Traits and Modern Misconceptions. It's AP that we're talking to. You'll have to check out his website, locationsoflore.com. And AP came across some really interesting things, and I think you're going to find it. I think you're going to like all this too. Now, AP, because of some of the things you brought up to me, first of all, first time on Coast to Coast, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Oh, thank you very much, Connie.
And tell me exactly, what is a vampire?
Sure. So when I first started getting into my research for doing the book, something I kind of realized rather quickly was that, well, I need to sort of define what a vampire is. I was looking to sort of contrast our modern notions about vampires with the actual folkloric beliefs surrounding vampires. But when you start going into legends and mythology and stuff like that, there's a lot of different creatures that often get mentioned in regards to vampires, different monsters and things that drink blood and whatnot. And so kind of pretty quickly I realized, like, well, I need to really sort of hone in on my own definition of a vampire and what constitutes a vampire for the purposes of my analysis, right? Because sometimes there's stories where, oh, you know, there was this monster that lived in the woods or something like that, and if people wandered in there, it would drink their blood. It's like, well, is that really a vampire, or is that just like some kind of monster that just happens to drink blood? So I came up with three criteria that I used sort of to define a vampire, regardless of sort of what the term for the creature was, because there's many different names for, you know, the undead and vampires and stuff like that, depending on the time and the place. But my three criteria number one was that the vampire is the corpse of a once living person, right? Mm. So it's not some kind of monster or non-human entity or something like that, like a demon or something. It was once a real person that has passed away. So there are some, you know, stories that, you know, it was like some kind of demon or something where it was never human to begin with. So for my purposes, I sort of discount those.
That makes sense. That's the one that we all pretty much know, right? That's the one. I would definitely remember that one. Yes, out of the movies. Yeah. Okay.
Sure. So it was once a real person that was, you know, living in a community or something like that. The second criteria was that the corpse is harming the living in some way. So I actually broadened it out a little bit beyond just the blood drinking to sort of any kind of harm that this undead corpse might be causing people. And when you look at some of the accounts, you'll find stories of the undead that, yes, they are drinking blood, but they're doing some other things as well. And I feel like if you just focus on the blood, you might miss out on some stories that I think are important for sort of understanding the entire phenomena. So, and then finally, my last criteria was that to destroy the vampire, action has to be taken against the corpse itself. So there's a physicality to vampires. They're not sort of spirits or something like that, kind of untethered. You know, there's a physical actual cause to some kind of crisis going on in a community, and that cause is buried in the local cemetery. So that was another sort of important criteria for me, that there was this physical aspect to dealing with vampires that might not be present with other kind of, you know, supernatural stories.
Hmm, interesting. See, now my whole, when I get the vision, I just see movies, right? Films, that's it. You know, that's it. Just films, movies, a little Gilligan's Island here and there, you know, that kind of thing. Everybody always does something vampire, right?
Sure.
And Count Chocula, right?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Count Chocula, right? Yeah. And then Sesame Street even had a vampire, right?
Yes. Count Von Count.
That's right. Did you include that in your findings?
I did talk about Count. I actually did talk about that character in my book.
Excellent. Excellent. I did not get that. I like that. I like that. So, so I get the visuals and everything that you said, but then you've got all these neat little things about, like, it's got to be, doesn't it have to be silver, the stake that goes into the heart as well? Does that have to be silver?
In my research, I look into stakes. There is a chapter about silver. The stakes are kind of an interesting thing. So that's very much kind of a ubiquitous thing in movies and stuff like that, right? You know, you stake the vampire through the heart, like a wooden stake through the heart, right? And that.
Wooden, maybe. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Was it wooden or was it silver? I'm sorry. It's a silver bullet with silver a werewolf. Bullet. I'm sorry.
You got to be ready. There's a lot to keep straight with vampire hunting.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So the stakes, you find that in the movies, right? You know, the wooden stake into the heart and it kills the vampire. And that certainly was, stakes are certainly present in folklore. They're not the only way to get rid of a vampire. But in various accounts I read, stakes were used to destroy the vampire. However, with a number of things I found, even if there was an actual, you know, sort of folkloric precedent to some of our, you know, our modern notions, there was oftentimes nuance to them that is sort of no longer present today, let's say. So, for example, with stakes, there were a number of beliefs where the type of wood used was important or relevant. Hmm. And it differed from place to place. Some places it was, oak or aspen, hawthorn, blackthorn. It varied. Hawthorn was kind of a big one. But that was important, that the stake would be made from a certain type of wood. One of the explanations for this is that, depending on the place, that wood had religious connotations. Played part in the crucifixion, something like that. You could surmise that by using that type of wood, it might have imbued the stake with kind of a spiritual power.
But
in some of the accounts too, there's kind of a specific detail about it. Now, oftentimes in movies and stuff, the vampire might like lunge at someone and they'll kind of like stake the vampire in the heart as they're lunging maybe or something like that, and that kills the vampire. But in some of the accounts that you read, they actually use some very specific language. They say that they'll stake the vampire, pinning it to the earth or fixing it to the ground. So in those beliefs, the stake would be like driven through the vampire to the ground beneath it, and thus they would be pinning the vampire in the ground in its grave. So it literally would be unable to rise, unable to get up out of its grave. So there was actually also sort of this practical reasoning surrounding the stake as well, which I find interesting. They might stake the vampire through the heart was certainly there, but other beliefs might involve staking it to the stomach or other parts. Staking through the heart, I think you also get this aspect of destroying the heart in the process. Heart, obviously, it's an organ associated with life and blood and stuff like that. And there were other beliefs that surrounded destroying the heart in various ways. So I think that with the whole idea of staking, there's a lot of different things that kind of come into play surrounding that belief. But as you can kind of see, there's all these kind of little nuances and little details that kind of have been sort of smoothed out and washed away over time when you sort of get into movies and stuff like that.
So AP, you're married, right?
I am, yes.
She can handle this. She's good to go. She likes this. She's all right.
Yes, she is.
Wear a scarf at night? What's going on?
Hang some garlic by the bed or something like that. She goes along with it, and she's visited some interesting things with me at times and stuff like that. So yeah,
excellent.
We have fun.
True love. I like that. Now, how did you get into this? Were you one of those little gothic kids? Did you always wear black? Did it happen as a kid? Or how did you decide, hey, vampires, that's what I'm going to go for?
That's the one for me. I've always sort of been interested in the supernatural and paranormal and things like that. When I was a kid, just for example, some of my favorite books were the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. books, if you're familiar with those.
Those were
a grade school favorite of mine. Even when I was like a little kid, my mom bought me this this book. It was for kids. It was a book about ghosts that she bought it for me at like a children's museum. And I loved that book. You know, it talked about like different like ghost beliefs from around the world and stuff. So I've always had sort of just interest in these kinds of things. What really got me on the vampire track was, this was a few years ago. I was in New York City, and I was walking around Times Square with my wife, who was my girlfriend at this point, and we came across a Ripley's Believe It or Not museum, and I really enjoy those. I think they're great. You know, they're full of all of these oddities and unique things. So when we came upon it in Times Square, I'm like, oh, we got to go in. I got to check it out. So, you know, we go into the Ripley's and, you know, I'm walking around seeing all the cool stuff they have. And we came across this one item that just, it really caught my eye. It was this kind of antique box that contained all these vials, and it had a stake and a cross and like a mold for making silver bullets and stuff. And it was
silver bullets.
Yeah. So it was labeled as a 19th century vampire killing kit, and it just had this great aesthetic. I thought it was really cool, and it kind of stayed with me. And I was thinking about it afterwards, after the trip, and I was like, you know, I want to learn more about these kits. What's the story? And so I took to the internet and started reading a bit about them, and I actually found that there was a little bit of controversy surrounding them. Some people believe that they are authentic pieces from the 1800s. Other people argue that they are, in fact, constructions of the 20th century using, antique pieces. So someone took an antique box and, antique vials or whatever, and sort of assembled it to create this kit. One of the arguments for it was, well, these kits kind of represent movie vampires and they, you know, the stuff in them, and they don't necessarily reflect the folklore. And that sort of assertion kind of got me on this track of like, well, what did people believe about vampires, in the past? And I knew that there were some differences just based on some documentaries I had watched and stuff like that. But I set out and I wanted to know, someone do a breakdown for me. I want to kind of go through every trait that I associate with like a movie vampire, let's say. And I want to know where it came from. You know, did people actually believe this in the past? Did it come from somewhere? Was it an invention of the movies or books or something? And I couldn't really find this sort of list that I wanted where it did this breakdown. And so I wound up kind of researching it. And I wound up sort of writing the book that I wanted to read. And that's how I arrived at Vampires of Lore.
Wow. And you have visited some really interesting places along the way too. I'm going to be talking about that with you here shortly. So you guys stick around, you vampire lovers. We're talking with AP, who is telling us all about vampires and everything he's learned about them, what he knows, the history, the different places he's actually traveled to as well, to see where some of these stories have come from. In fact, that's a good question that when we come back, I'm definitely going to have to ask AP about. Does he believe in the vampire as well as know all about the history and know more than anybody else would in one sitting? But does he believe in them? Because here's something interesting. Werewolves, right? We all are like, oh, yeah, in the movies. However, Dogman. Okay, yeah, you can see how that relates, right? We've learned that recently, right? Well, or within the last couple of years. But then when you have somebody you know that sees a Dogman and they say that their clothes are ripped and shredded as if they were a human turned into a werewolf like the old stories, it makes you wonder about the vampires too. Huh. So let's ask him that when we come back. AP's with us talking about vampires, everything you've ever wanted to know. Connie Willis here. You're listening to Coast AM. It's another very interesting show here on Coast to Coast AM. The Real Theater of the Mind is what's going on. Connie Willis here out of the Blue Rock Talk Studios. Yeah, it's interesting the way the world is changing, right? Constantly. And as I'm now doing the recording or the live streams here, I guess, well, it's not really a stream, is it? It's live, though. And the interesting thing about it is, I would go to the studios and I would always know there was always people at radio stations that would always bring their dog, you know, and they'd be in a studio with them or maybe in the one outside of the studio, and maybe their dog wouldn't worry about trying to get in with them. Now mine would, she'd have to be on my lap or something like that, or you'd hear all the noise. So I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I'm at home. Okay. Got my little girl here. What's little Penny girl going to do? And you know, she's been really good. Everything's good. But one of the things I forgot is she does a lot of talking in her sleep, a lot of moaning, she's got some good dreams going on along the way. And I just heard that. And I just think it's got a sound. I don't know what it sounds like on the microphone. I got a great microphone here. Could pick up something like moans and groans. And if you hear that, that's just my little girl having a little dream. That's all it is. And it just started happening. So tickled me a little bit to hear that. So, that's the way things are happening nowadays. It's all different. Watching news people from their own homes with their bedrooms in the back, right? I'm always like, don't have the bedroom in the back. Don't have the bathroom in the back either. Find a wall somewhere, right? So we're talking with AP here tonight, and he is a vampire fanatic. Actually, AP, what have people called you? Do they call you a fanatic or a freak or what kind of? I know they've got a name for you. They have to. It's just the way it is because you are into this, which is awesome. For anybody that's looking for research, by the way, I'm just kind of kidding you a little bit because I know you have sense humor.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Maybe vampire enthusiast. I'm not sure.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah, that's in front of you, right behind your back. Yeah, oh, man, what's with this guy, right? So one of the things I did want to ask you, yeah, is I know you got a lot more to tell, but you know, I don't know if you heard me talking about the werewolf thing where a lot of people in the UK were connecting with them a lot more, hearing about the dog man, which is really kind of like, ooh, is that where we got the werewolf, you know, from? Is it from those stories that now the dog man that we see looks like a dog walking around? Well, some people, in fact, one that I know in particular, Cryptid 559, all these names that everybody has, he has actually seen a dog man, and the clothes, the pants, like shorts, I guess more like shorts, were shredded, just like the myths of the werewolf that was a man and became the werewolf, and the clothes tore off, right? Because it all the muscles and everything bulging out. So that's where it was kind of like, whoa, that's getting real. Did all those stories come from something real? So what about that with vampires? I'm just thinking that might be the same.
So from the research I've done, looking at the historical accounts, I personally am not yet convinced that undead corpses are actually sort of clawing their way out of graves or something like that. I would say that, you know, aspects of vampire accounts, like, you know, visitations by deceased and things like that, certainly are present in various belief systems. So I think that then just becomes a matter of, you know, someone's supernatural interpretation or supernatural worldview, something like that. I would say, though, that, you know, are vampires real? It depends on who you ask. You know, there was a case in 2004 of a rural village in Romania that believed they were being assaulted by a vampire, and they actually exhumed the corpse of someone and took action against that corpse. So, still kind of, you know, in certain places, you know, very rural, these beliefs, may still be present. And, you know, I think it is a testament to the, you know, the impact of them in, you know, the cultural heritage. You know, in my research, there certainly I think there's a case to be made, and this theory has been around for a little while now, where what people were seeing with vampires, at least some of it, could be explained by misinterpretations of the decomposition process and things like that, because there are a number of historical accounts where people dug up these corpses and they saw things that didn't make sense to them. And then that then sort of tied into this this greater issue of some kind of illness or something like that that was going on in the community.
What would that be? What would that have been that they would see?
Sure. So, a scenario, let's say, sort of a generalized scenario. You know, you'd have, say, a community, a village, you know, 1700, something like that. And, you know, people would start getting sick. People would start dying. And these might be young people or seemingly healthy people. And, you know, that wouldn't make sense to the populace, right? Because, you know, this is, you know, before germ theory and things like that. So they start seeing, you know, person after person maybe getting sick from something or something like that. And they're looking for a cause. They're looking for an explanation. And in these cases, suspicion fell on the dead. They were, you know, they would kind of look around and say, well, this all started when this person died unexpectedly. Maybe there's something going on with this person who died. Let's exhume the corpse and take a look. So when they would exhume the corpse and they would look at it, there were certain kinds of vampiric signs. It might be a lack of decomposition. So the person would look, they would look sort of fresh and alive, right? Even though they'd been dead for some months or something like that. It might be that the person looked sort of bloated, like they had gained weight. So they actually might look sort of like healthier than they did in life. They might be kind of red in the face and bigger. You know, normally, I think even today, when people think of sort of, you know, a body decomposing, you kind of think they kind of start where they were and they move towards skeleton. So you often kind of think of decomposition as you're at some point towards skeleton. That is not necessarily the case. You know, people would look at these corpses and it might look like they might have hair that's grown or fresh skin or fresh nails, things like that. And these are actually all these things I'm describing are, it may look that way when looking at the decomposition process, not to be too gruesome here or anything like that, but, you know, like gases can build up in the body that causes bloating, like the layer of skin beneath the normal skin may look like fresh skin, that kind of thing. So they actually were kind of seeing things that could be part of the normal process, but were unfamiliar to them. And someone might look, the body may look fresh, because they're, you know, due to the conditions, maybe it was cold, someone died in the winter or something like that, and so they were preserved. Another sign that would have been quite striking that you see come up in some accounts was blood around the mouth. So there are these accounts where they dug up the corpse, this person looks fresh, they look as if they were alive, and they see this blood around the mouth, and they go, that blood is the blood that they sucked from their victims, and that's what's causing this, you know, this illness that we're seeing. Now, actually, blood or fluid around the mouth actually also can be part of the normal process. But, you know, it's quite surprising, quite shocking, even I think to someone today, if someone were to see that. So you can see how that community was trying, they were trying to connect the dots here and explain something that was going on. And, you know, suspicion fell on the dead. They're seeing things that to them don't make sense, that seem unnatural. And thus, that was their confirmation that this was a vampire.
You know, one of the things about vampires to me is I always, it just seemed like they were always somewhere else in another country. They were never here in the United States. Please don't tell me that they jumped the boat and came over here, even though you don't really believe it. but the stories probably did, right? So,
Absolutely,
I mean, is there, you know, where are the most stories? Where are they mostly known to be?
Sure. So there are vampire tales in various different countries. And I talk about, different ones in my book. I go into some different stories. But there actually are a number of vampire incidents that have occurred in the United States, a lot of them in the New England area.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
I think that would make sense. Yeah.
So this belief, in sort of, the threat of the dead, let's say, did carry over, to the New World. And there are a number of different vampire incidents. I've visited the graves of some of these people, which was, it's kind of an interesting experience to go there and sort of and think about it, because these days you think about vampires, oftentimes you think of like the Halloween vampire in movies and all that, and it's very much like a fictionalized thing. But when you're sort of really there, at a grave where this person was exhumed and something was something was done to the corpse, right? The corpse was mutilated in some fashion. It's poignant in a way. It speaks to the power of these beliefs and the fear that could grip a community.
You have on your website, I'm looking at it as you're talking, you've got some great pictures in here. And have you been to all these places, and are these your pictures?
Yes, I've been to these places. They are pictures I've taken.
Okay, so it is a blog then. It's it's really amazing here. You have got story after story after story. The abandoned zoo enclosures in Boston. What was that one about?
Oh, that's kind of a fun one. Some of the places I go to, they just kind of have sort of a spooky vibe to them or something like that. So that was part of the zoo in Boston, the Franklin Park Zoo, and it's kind of changed its footprint over the years. And so there was a section of the zoo that is no longer used. So it's part of the overall park, but it's no longer part of the zoo. So there are these old bear cages and things that kind of date back to the beginning of the zoo, I think in the 1800s. And so they have this kind of grandeur to them, but now they're kind of just sort of sitting and idle, and they're sort of surrounded by trees. So there's a really cool vibe when you go there. And it's interesting to think that, there was a time when, the like throngs of people were coming and walking up these steps to see this kind of this giant bear enclosure with this giant city seal and stone behind it. But now it's sort of just sort of sitting silently.
Ah, now this one, these great pictures, just excellent pictures. Good job.
Thank you.
Vampire case of Sarah Tillinghast.
Yes. Sarah Tillinghast. Yes. So that's one of the New England vampire accounts. So that was an interesting one. Basically, the story is kind of like, and this story dates back to the 1700s, and then it was written down in the 1800s sometime later. So I think there's some kind of mythologizing that kind of goes into it, but essentially, like this father has a sort of prophetic dream about having an orchard, and half the orchard dies, turns out to sort of mean that he's going to like lose half his children. But some of his children start getting sick and passing away, and one of the daughters kind of says that during the night, one of the other daughters passed away. Sarah was causing her this extreme pain by like sitting on parts of her body. So ultimately they go, they exhume Sarah's body. And they sort of, they see that it seems like undecayed, essentially.
So that makes the difference with people. As soon as they see that, it's a vampire.
Yeah. So, I mean, and actually they exhumed, I think, a number of the corpses, but Sarah's was the one that stood out to them, that like, oh, this one's problematic. And she's the first, that she was supposedly the first to have died. And so they see fresh blood in the heart, or what they presume to be fresh blood. So that these are all kind of signs to them that something is amiss. So they wind up cutting out the heart and burning it on a rock. And then all the corpses are interred. Apparently like the wife, who I guess was ill, survives, but another child, son, dies subsequently. So that's one where I visited the cemetery where she was buried. It's not clear which stone is her. The cemetery is very old, but she's one of those, probably one of the field stones that's unmarked is most likely hers. But it was, it's an interesting account. I think it was it like 1799, I want to say, is when she passed away. So it dates back, you know, quite a ways. And interestingly, this was in Exeter, Rhode Island. And there's another vampire incident in the same town, Exeter, Rhode Island, just about 100 years later, which is a very well-known vampire account, the case of Mercy Brown, which...
Oh, yeah, that's a big one, yes.
Yes, that comes up in a lot of shows and things like that. But, you know, that one is also, you know, sort of quite... you know, it's you can only imagine kind of what some of the people were going through in some of these incidents, right? Like in the case of, you know, the case of Tillinghast, you can imagine sort of, you know, these parents like losing children, right? In the case of Mercy Brown, George Brown, who's the father, he lost his wife, one daughter, and then another daughter, Mercy, and then his last remaining child, his son, is also sick. During this time, the illness, which a lot of these stories are involved with, was known as consumption. Today, it's known as tuberculosis. Hundreds of years ago, there wasn't much of a treatment for consumption. People, you know, doctors thought it might be due to like the moist air or something like that. In the Mercy Brown case, the brother Edwin actually spends some time, I believe, in Colorado for the dry air, thinking that that will help him, but it doesn't, and he returns. So, you know, you can think about it as sort of, you know, the doctors and medical science didn't really have anything for these people. There was no treatment. There was nothing else to be done. So you can think of, say, George Brown, the father, watching family members die. Now he sees his last remaining child, his son Edwin, is sick with consumption, and there's nothing he can do, right? But then, you know, presumably somebody in the town comes to him and says, well, it could be that the dead are causing this, and there might be a way to save your son. So in the Mercy Brown case, what happens is the wife, the elder daughter, and then Mercy, who was like 19 when she passed away, they're all exhumed, and their corpses are examined. The mother and the older daughter, they're decomposed to the point that they're beyond suspicion. But Mercy, who had been dead a few months, I think she had died in the winter, she seems fresh and as if she were still alive, as if she were sleeping.
Whoa, vampires, locations of lore.com. That's where you want to go. If you look at it, you're going to read the same as me. You're going to go, oh, that's weird. But more about vampires when we come back. Connie Willis here with Coast to Coast AM. And by the way, we're going to be taking your phone calls for any questions.